Hi, everyone. I'm Lindsay Lewis, editor of Building Enclosure. Thanks for listening along with us today. I'm joined by Doug Cohen, principal with Walter P. Moore, to talk about designing for severe weather. Doug, thanks for sitting with us today.
Happy to be here.
So how has severe weather changed the way we look at design and construction?
You know, one thing that I'm noticing is that owners have become more conscientious about risk. We're trying to help educate them and allow them to make informed decisions about the design and construction process and the cost of these protective measures.
So with that being said, how do we go about designing more resilient buildings?
It depends upon what you're willing to tolerate or accept. What are the implications of the disruption? Is this a hospital, a trauma center, or is this a warehouse with non-vital storage? Resilience really depends upon the geographic location of the building. For instance, on the West Coast, you've got seismic and wildfire things to pay attention to. In the North, snow loads. In the Plain States, tornadoes and hail. In the South and the East Coast, flood protection. What are we going to go and do with that?
Well, flood has been a big one. So let's talk about some of the hurricane issues we've had down south. What do we see in areas like Miami-Dade when it comes to building codes and designing for severe weather?
Miami-Dade suffered tremendous effects from Hurricane Andrew. And as a result, they proactively improved the building code to help prevent a repeat of the past effects. Building codes in general, while they're becoming more complicated all around, we are getting better and stronger buildings. Now, this does result in the increase in the overall cost of the buildings. However, there's a reduction in the minor inconveniences that can happen as a result of a downed building. One thing that we haven't seen in the building codes and the changes here and there, we haven't seen requirements for injector pits and check valves that really stop the water from backing up into the building. Now, as a firm-wide standard inquiry, we try to go and make sure that we put these check valves and things in to prohibit that from happening in flood protection design, but we're really not seeing that as a consistent code across the board.
So you mentioned injector pits and check valves. Can you explain what those are?
Sure. A check valve is, say, for instance, your stormwater and also sanitary sewer coming out of the building. What you don't want is for a flood to happen and your building is resilient and is no longer allowing flood water to enter the building, but the water could enter, say, from the manhole of a sanitary sewer. So the flood water's there, it pushes, now the weight of that water pushes the sanitary sewer into the building. And so we put a check valve on that to prohibit water from going the reverse direction. And pits and things, that's just to go and make sure that we've got pumps on the inside of the building so that in particular areas that we're putting the pits in there with the pumps to make sure that as water comes into particular areas that we're able to pump it out.
That's so interesting. So I guess that kind of leads into my next question I have for you. What elements are important to consider when preparing buildings for natural hazards?
One thing is we need to go and determine what is your risk tolerance. There's going to be a disruption of operations. Are we trying to prohibit a catastrophic failure? Is this a place that's going to serve as a place of refuge? In that instance, failure is not an option. Things you need to consider are the owner's cost of tolerance, the tolerance of the risk, the areas, the types of risk the owners are concerned about, and then the cost of those specific improvements. Say we were talking about flood protection a moment ago. So what would be the cost of that flood protection? Then the owner will do a comparison of the cost of the protection versus the cost of the failure. And really only the owner can decide in the end which way they would prefer to go.
So when it comes to specific building materials, are there any on the market designed for severe weather?
Well, yes, but we'll, instead of going to a particular product, some materials, you know, different materials perform better to different events. Thin wood planking burns faster in forest fires, and it's also subject to termite damage. Clay-based materials are more fire tolerant, but they're brittle. Steel is subject to corrosion and melting, melting during high temperatures, and that results in a loss of strength. So your material selection can depend upon the severe weather event you're trying to resist. As another example, concrete and masonry, that tends to be better with fire. Non-flammable, you know, fire materials work best in fire zones. What we do, we recommend and have a preference for reinforced concrete for passive flood protection. Now, that's also not subject to corrosion. So that's an example of building protection and a type of material.
Well, let's talk about wind-driven rain. Are there any products out there to capture or control stormwater?
There is. And so just specific to wind-driven rain, it can happen. And an example that I've used a number of times, when you're designing a parking garage, you're going to have, say, when there's a storm happening, cars bring in water from those cars. And as they're driving around, water's falling off and is now on the surface inside the building. Inlets need to be designed inside that garage to go and take on some of that water that's being brought by the cars. You also have, you can have windblown rain coming in. And so you have inlets inside the garage or the building to go and pull that and take that rainwater away. And that goes down to a sump system, a pit, and a pump then puts that water out. So you can have that. There are other ways to go and take care of some windblown rain. You can have a rain screen for the building facade. It's designed to go, and when the rain water hits it, it really is trying to make it so it hits, the rain hits it and it sheets straight down. But that rain screen is also still porous. So it could go all the way through it if you're going, if you've got horizontal rain, but if it's coming slide on an example, on an angle, it'll most often come straight down.
So I'm no FEMA expert, but I'm curious, does FEMA have any standards for the building industry?
They do, and there's a number of them. Mm-hmm. They have a variety of standards, and it really depends upon the risk that you're trying to protect. And so just one example is FEMA 551, and that's helping you select appropriate mitigation measures for flood prone structures. And as an example inside of that, it sets minimum finished floor elevation requirements. It provides wind standards. So that's an example, but it really just depends upon what type of risk you're trying to go and design against.
Now, in your line of work, do you ever come across any testing that's being done in the industry? I guess specifically being conducted in regards to designing for severe storms?
Absolutely. And severe storms and other types of severe events. So there are a number of universities that conduct seismic testing. They also do fire resistance testing. And when it comes to the design on the flood protection side, since we're talking about storms, we always recommend and encourage commissioning and testing for the flood protection devices after they're installed. So as an example, we'll go in and design flood protection along the face of the building all the way along. And then with the various flood protection elements, then we'll go and make sure that we are having some commissioning testing on that. So the level of rainwater or the level of flooding meets the level of the protection. And so we're actually having a flooding event on there. You just have a bladder on one side of it. And you have the water going and hitting that wall. And then you're checking and testing and making sure that there's no water coming through it.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I had never thought about the testing that goes into it. You know, how do you test for severe weather without having severe weather? So that's really interesting.
That's right. You know, the weight of water is so, the strength of water is so powerful, and it will find the path of least resistance. And so we want to make sure that there is no pathway after you've got your flood protection, because this is a one time of, you know, thing, we want to make sure that this is not happening. And you could put a great deal of construction and money towards your flood protection. And if we're not absolutely certain it's not working, then you're still wondering whether it's actually going to be resilient when that flood happens.
Right. Well, one last question to pick your brain. How do you think the AEC industry will navigate designing and constructing as our weather just continues to change and become more severe in certain areas?
I see that we are, I'm seeing a heightened awareness as a result of greater protection. It's occurring more and more often. People are becoming more aware of this. This means that additional protection is more frequently being considered in the building process. Now, my expectation is that as we're seeing more of this additional protection is occurring, that you're going to have an increase in construction cost. Of course, that's going to happen. Not a significant increase, but there will be an increase in construction cost, but that's paid to minimize the risk. There will be a result of less future disruptions in buildings and a greater resilience and redundance of that finished product.
Well, thank you again, Doug, for your time today.
This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me.
If anyone listening has any questions, please feel free to reach out to myself or Doug, and we'd love to continue the conversation. Until next time, visit us on buildingenclosureonline.com for all your technical and educational resources.